When a crime is committed, the perpetrator inevitably leaves behind something, a description, DNA, or physical evidence. This is the criminal's print on the scene. Welcome to the Criminal Prints Podcast, Episode 7.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Criminal Prints Podcast, Episode 7. This is Zach.
And I'm Jaron.
And today we're going to be talking about the murder of Lindsay Buziak. Lindsay was born on November 2nd, 1983, in Victoria, Canada. And her parents are Jeff and Evelyn Buziak. And Lindsay also has a sister by the name of Sarah.
When Lindsay was young, she attended Lake Hill Elementary School. She got a little older and went to high school at Reynolds Secondary School. And when she was done with high school, she got her real estate license. All of this is in the British Columbia area in Canada. She was a very caring and generous person, and she was described as having an incredible smile that would warm up a room, and she had just tons of friends.
Her first real estate job was in Victoria, Canada, and that's a population of around 370,000. So she then returned to Victoria and got on with Remax Real Estate. And according to her father, Jeff, she had found what she loved, and that's what she wanted to do. Now, Lindsay was, there was 1,300 real estate agents working in the area, and she was very young. She was 24 years old. Less than 20 of the 1,300 agents were under the age of 25. And so she was very goal-oriented. She was extremely focused on her career, and she took pride in what she did and in the personal service that she gave to her clients.
So the negative parts of this story began in January 2008. She received a phone call from a potential client, or what she believed to be a potential client. The call was on her personal cell phone, and it was a female caller. She said that her and her husband were, quote, in a hurry to buy a $1 million home, and that they had to do it in 2 days. She claimed that she had a little bit of an accent, and that it sounded maybe like it was Spanish, but, quote, but not really.
She also thought that the caller may have been faking this accent in order to conceal her identity. And Lindsay was uneasy about this call, just something about it didn't sit right with her. Especially because we know that this call was made to her personal cell phone. And Lindsay didn't give this number out very often. And so she asked the caller, she said, hey, how'd you get this number? Because she was relatively new to Remax. And the lady said that a previous client of Lindsay's had given her Lindsay's personal cell phone number. Lindsay tried to verify this information with the previous clients and tried to contact them. But unfortunately, the clients were out of the area and unreachable.
So because she felt very uncomfortable with the whole situation, she asked her boyfriend, his name was Jason Zylo, for advice and what she should do. And Jason's advice was, well, show the house, and since you're uncomfortable for your safety, I'll sit outside in my car while you show the house. He encouraged her to take on the client because, well, it's a $1 million home, and so it's going to be, you know, a lot of money for a real estate agent, a good commission. Interestingly, the listing agent, and the two realtors that were specifically connected to the property never received any call or contact from the same people that contacted her.
That is very interesting. So we know next, Lindsay finds a property that she thinks fits. You know, they gave her notes what they were looking for, and she finds this property that she thinks they would be interested in. And this house was actually for sale for $964,900, and it was located at 1702 DeSosa Place in Victoria, British Columbia. $964,000. Holy cow, I wish I had that kind of money to spend on a house.
Yeah, so do I.
So Lindsay sets up an appointment to meet with the possible buyers on February 2nd, 2008, at 5:30 p.m. So originally, The client, the lady that she'd talked to, told Lindsay that her husband would not be attending the showing and that she would be coming alone.
So on February 2nd, 2008, we're now on the day of the crime. Lindsay and Jason ate lunch at a restaurant. The bill was paid at 4:24 p.m., and they left separately in their own vehicles. Jason, we know, drove to an auto shop to pick up his friend, and that's verifiable. He was running a little late, but that's verifiable because he's on the CCTV at the shop, leaving at 5:30.
And it's believed that Lindsay drove home to change her clothes at this point. So we do know for a fact that at 5:29 p.m., so just a minute before the appointment, the lockbox, or the key where they keep the lock, was accessed by Lindsay for access to the house. At approximately 5:30 p.m., two witnesses saw a couple walking into the cul-de-sac and saw Lindsay greeting them by the back of her car. Lindsay was parked in the driveway. So this is different than what the lady had told Lindsay, because the male, we don't know exactly who it is or what relationship, but he was there. And so while Jason was driving, he texted Lindsay and he said, quote, "I'll come meet you and I'll be there in 10 or 15 minutes. So Lindsay responded, "Okay, I'll see you in a bit. I gotta go. The Mexicans are here." So the Mexicans was a shorthand name that Lindsay gave for the clients. And this is partially because of the lady's accent over the phone and because she couldn't quite recognize where the accent was from.
It was just something to call them that Jason would recognize them as the clients. The man was actually described as being 6 foot tall. He was Caucasian and he had dark hair. The female was described as having blonde hair and being aged 35 to 45, and she was wearing a very distinctively patterned dress. There is actually a police sketch of the female. We'll go ahead and post that to our Facebook and Twitter so you can check it out. At 5:38, Jason sends Lindsay a text that says, quote, "just a couple minutes away." And then around 5:40, so just a couple minutes later, Jason and the friend that he now has with him arrive at the house. As they were driving up, Jason saw a man and a woman coming out of the front door. But upon seeing Jason and his friend, they immediately turned around and they went back into the house.
So I don't know about you, Jaron, but to me, this is kind of a red flag that they would immediately turn around and go straight back into the house.
Yeah, that's kind of it would strike you as being strange.
So Jason had his vehicle parked at a distance on the opposite side of the road, but to where he could still see. So then he sat there for approximately 10 minutes and then decided to turn around in the cul-de-sac and parked by the house for an additional 10 minutes. So then Jason texted Lindsay again, and the text was, quote, "are you okay?" Unfortunately, this text was never looked at and or never opened. So at this point, 20 minutes had passed, and Jason and his friend decided to walk up to the front door and attempted to open the door. It was locked, so he repeatedly knocked but got no answer, and there was no sign of movement inside the house.
So through a mottled piece of glass, which is, it's like glass that has color spots and stains in it, he could see her shoes in the entrance hallway. So right off the bat, something prompted him to call 911. So this is 6:05. He calls 911. Jason's friend gets into the garden area, which is kind of around the back of the house, and he sees that the patio door is open. We're not exactly sure how, if Jason helped him get over the fence, or we do know that there was reports of a little hole in the fence, but either way, Jason's friend gets into the backyard, goes through the patio door, and goes through the house to the front door and opens the door up for Jason.
So this is a major red flag, at least in my opinion. So Jason went straight up the stairs and found Lindsay's body in a pool of blood.
And again, I want to emphasize, this is almost $1 million home. It's a pretty big home.
It is.
And he went straight to her.
That just seems...
it's one of those things that it feels a little unusual.
It does. Why would he know exactly where to go and exactly where she was in the house?
So we do know that Jason's friend then calls 911 as well. They've now discovered the body. And police had already been on the way.
Yeah, they were on the way from his previous phone call that he made at 6:05. His friend could hear sirens coming when he was talking to the dispatcher. And when police arrived, Jason and his friend were waving their arms in front of the upstairs bedroom window. So police went up the stairs to the bedroom where Lindsay's body was and immediately took Jason and his friend separately to the police station.
Which definitely seems like the appropriate course of action at this point. You have a dead woman and you have two young men, and obviously you would split them up, take them into the police station and talk to them separately.
Yeah, I mean, they're literally right smack at the center of the crime scene.
They were, and they were the only people there. It was literally in a vacant home. So Lindsay was unfortunately pronounced dead when the paramedics arrived shortly after. And all we know about the scene is that it was a very gruesome attack. She was stabbed over 40 times. And gruesome attacks like this with knives, you have to wonder, Zach, do you think it could have been a personal attack?
I absolutely do. Because of the amount of stab wounds, I think it could very likely be a personal attack, in my opinion.
So generally, in a situation like this, there's defensive wounds. In this case, there were no defensive wounds on her body. It's a little unusual, but she may have not known the attack was coming, and perhaps even been stabbed when she was facing away from the killer.
And we know that at the beginning, she was very hesitant. So maybe she kind of got to know him a little bit and thought, oh, this is okay, and let her guard down, which is unfortunate, but very possible.
Yeah, and it's most likely. You meet somebody, and you're not generally going to think, hey, they seem like a killer.
So at 5:41 p.m., Lindsay's phone makes a pocket dial. And authorities believe that this call actually was a result from the attack. And another note that is very interesting is there was no sign of any sexual assault and no personal belongings of Lindsay's were stolen.
So this is really a unique kind of piece of evidence where her phone dials a number at 5:41. So there is reason to believe that that is when the attack happened. As far as evidence goes, there's actually another important phone, and that's the phone that was used to contact Lindsay. It happens to be, in this case, a burner phone. A burner phone, for anyone who doesn't know, is a phone used for the sole purpose of anonymity. Generally, that's known for being used in crime.
The phone was purchased in November 2007 in Vancouver, and it was activated under the name of Paulo Rodriguez, which is believed by police to be a fake name.
Which, by the way, would be fitting with the fake Mexican accent.
It certainly would. And we know that the address that was given at the time of the activation was a legitimate address. Unfortunately, it was the address to a Vancouver business. Police believed it was picked at random, and they don't believe the business has any connection to this case. And so the phone had unfortunately never been used before the first call was made to Lindsay.
Which means there's no connections with any other people or any other places, which is the point of a burner phone. In fact, the only thing this phone ever did was it made 6 total calls, and they were all to Lindsay. It did give us one piece of information, however. It pinged, and one of their pings, they can tell that it was on a ferry coming to Victoria from Vancouver the day before the murder.
Man, this is brutal. At least in my opinion, this has calculation, cold-blooded murder written all over it.
It absolutely does. And then, as soon as they're done, they went ahead and deactivated the phone. It hasn't been used since, and the police obviously believe it was purchased as a burner phone, and it's now been discarded.
Another interesting unfortunate fact is no DNA or fingerprints were found at the scene. And this is despite the fact that it was a very gruesome, bloody scene. So a lot of times in these situations, you find DNA, you find prints, there's evidence. But unfortunately, with this situation, there was nothing. With the lack of forensic evidence and the use of a burner phone, it's led many people, including law enforcement, to believe that this was a targeted and or professional hit. Police believe that there was a significant degree of planning that went into the murder, and the killers knew exactly how to carry out the murder and also cover their tracks. So experts agree this was very possibly a personal attack, and also somebody that was close to Lindsay planned it and or hired the killers.
A little bit about Lindsay. For an attack like this, you would think that maybe she has some connections in crime, maybe she's been up to something, but she wasn't known to be involved in any criminal activity. And so that's kind of an interesting deal. Sergeant Horsley says, quote, "There is nothing in her life, and we have conducted an extensive background check, that would indicate that she was involved in anything criminal, in anything of a domestic violence relationship, and that is the most perplexing thing." He also said, quote, "It is also possible Buziak's killers were under the mistaken impression she had revealed information she shouldn't have, or perhaps she was somehow connected to a dangerous person without knowing it."
I'm going to go back a little bit here to Jason, but we know that Jason was at the scene, but he has fully cooperated with law enforcement. He's given several interviews, and he's even passed a lie detector test. What is a little interesting is he will not give his DNA. He refuses to give his DNA, but he has fully cooperated, which is a great thing.
And I can kind of understand not giving your DNA. There's privacy concerns, and I would share those concerns. And there's also possibility that maybe there's other things in his past that he just doesn't want his DNA in police hands. So we have another quote here from Sergeant Horsley again. He says, quote, "You can be a person who just works and minds their own business in Victoria, yet through a very brief network of friends, you could be absolutely connected to people that are involved in very bad things." The thing I'm kind of picking up here is almost a theme of organized crime, as if they think that she could have somehow been around really bad people and not known it.
Certainly. Maybe wasn't anything intentional, but just was in the wrong situation at the wrong time.
Yeah, knew the wrong people who were doing the wrong things, and unfortunately, not anything they believe that she was involved in.
Sergeant Dean Jansen said, quote, "This killing was very organized. There was a lot of planning and effort and forethought. These are the most complex crimes, and this is the most egregious crime, and often they can become long-term and complicated. There are people in the community who are withholding information. We know there's a bit of cone of silence around this case." That's not a good thing that he believes there's a cone of silence.
No, it's not, and I hate to sound like a broken record, but again, it just makes me think this is organized, and it's not just one person that knew about it, it seems.
So we know that with some of the later events, that Lindsay's father, Jeff, has, in my words, dedicated his life to solving this case. He's given up absolutely everything to find justice for his daughter. And that's really honorable, because that shows the love that he had for his daughter.
Yeah, and in fact, he has voluntary PIs working with him, and just people that are volunteering to help him. And he's put so much time and energy into it. It's actually cost him his job. It's cost him a lot of personal sacrifices. But he says he's, quote, all in, and that's what that means. So,
and so we know that he does an annual walk in remembrance of Lindsay to keep her case in the public eye. And recently, Jeff was actually, about a week and a half ago, on the Dr. Phil show.
Yeah, and when he was on the show, he had a claim that I didn't see in any of my researching, that she told him that she had saw something, and she wouldn't say what it was, and she wouldn't say who it was involving, just that she saw something, and she'd eventually tell him.
With the lack of better words, I think it's safe to say that Jeff was extremely unhappy with law enforcement.
Yeah, I would agree. He seemed very unimpressed.
Certainly not a fan whatsoever of what they are doing and or what they have done to this point.
And I can't say that I blame him in this case.
No, and you know, this is different because a lot of the cases we've covered, law enforcement have been incredible and they're doing every single thing they can to catch the suspects. But we know that in 2010, they were going to make it a cold case, but they changed their mind when Jeff, the father, requested the documents. So the police refused to classify this as a cold case. They won't necessarily go seek help of others, release information, or even assign a specific detective to this case.
The only detectives assigned the case, you know, they have a big list of cases, and that just happens to be one of them on there. So it's the type of deal where evidence would have to hit them in the face for them to actually go after it.
Yeah, that freaking sucks.
Yeah, it really does. And Jeff actually told the story on the Dr. Phil show of his meeting with the police department when they were going to make it a cold case, and how he told them, all right, well, then you can give me all the information. And right then and there, they said, actually, we've decided it's not going to be a cold case. The Zalo family has been investigated because they have connections with the cul-de-sac, or this area where this home was being developed. It's actually named after an associate of Jason's mother. The impression I get in researching it is that the family has been willing to work with authorities, and they have found nothing, and in fact say that they are not involved in the crime as far as they can tell. So that brings us to our kind of theories on the case. Zach, what do you got?
So the first thing that kind of stuck out in my mind, but doesn't necessarily fit, was it possible that they were serial killers? Because it was a cold, calculated case. It seemed like these people knew exactly what they were doing and that they'd done it before. But unfortunately, I couldn't see any other crimes that really matched this criteria. And we know that serial killers certainly like to stick to the same modus of operation, or MO. So even though it's intriguing, and they did seem like they were, lack of better words, experts at it, the serial killer just doesn't make a whole lot of sense because of the lack of MO.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. It does kind of match how a serial killer kills, but in order to be a serial killer, you have to do it more than once, and there's nothing to lead us to believe that they have done this or anything like it more than once.
Another possible one is, could it be drug-related?
Not necessarily so much drug use, but maybe like a distribution ring type thing is
exactly
one of the things going around.
Yeah, did she have possible connections with somebody that was into drugs or sold drugs?
Yeah.
Was she around the wrong people?
It's been said that she attempted to contact somebody who was a childhood friend or something of that nature, who was shortly after locked up in a huge drug bust, a distribution ring in Alberta, Canada. And so, you know, there's been some speculation. Could they have maybe thought she was an informant? It seems like a bit of a long shot, but there is kind of a weird connection there.
I know I've read stuff saying that it was possibly the drug cartel that took her out because they thought she was possibly an informant. But law enforcement has been pretty adamant that they looked into this and they do not think that's what happened.
So she lived on and off anyway with Jason. Her dad mentioned that she had seen something. Could that have something to do with Jason?
In my opinion, at least, this is kind of my favorite theory, I would say. I think it's very possible that she saw something she wasn't supposed to. Maybe Jason was into something he shouldn't have been. There are certain parts of Jason's story, and I'm sure you will agree, that at least in my mind do not add up and don't make any sense.
Yeah, I agree. The first one to me that is really strange is he waited 20 whole minutes, which maybe isn't super unreasonable, but that was 20 minutes after seeing them what looked like on the way out, which seems strange.
Yeah, and as we mentioned before, I mean, that's, you see him coming out, you clearly don't see your girlfriend leaving. He doesn't see Lindsay leaving. He doesn't see this other couple leaving. Why in the world would you wait at this point?
Yeah, and then he called 911 right off the bat. As soon as he started knocking and there was no answer, he called 911. And I find it strange that he would go from little suspicion, not even enough to get out of the car, to call 911 suspicion that quickly.
Yeah, that we need to get in this house right now. Yeah, at what point did he go from maybe something's going on to full-blown panic? We also talked about how he went immediately straight to the room that had her body in it. This is another red flag to me because, as Jaron mentioned earlier, very expensive, large house. How did he know exactly where to go to? And within seconds of getting in that house, go to the body.
And that could absolutely be luck, but it is a little unusual. I know if I were to go search for somebody in a home, I wouldn't go upstairs as my first searching area, just me personally.
Yeah, I would go looking around exactly what's around me, try to find something, some signs, but he went straight up the stairs.
The speculation here, obviously, isn't that he actually did the killing. It's just that maybe he had something to do with the planning. And I want to be crystal clear that he is not considered a suspect. And the only reason we kind of bring him up and talk about him is there's a few kind of weird things in the case. And he really is the only person that was around when it happened other than the two people.
And to be honest, at this point, there's not a lot of evidence. As Jaron was saying, we really don't know the suspects. So there's unfortunately very little to go off of in this case. So if you have any information about the murder of Lindsay Buziak, we're going to give you the number of the tip line, and it's 1-888-980-1919. And I personally would love to see this couple brought to justice, and I would love to see it get solved.
Yeah, this is recent enough that these killers are most likely still alive, they're still around, and they're still dangerous. So if you know anything at all, if you know anyone who knows anything at all, it's very important people like this are brought to justice.
And so that is Episode 7, The Murder of Lindsay Buziak. We thank everybody for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Please check out our Facebook and our Twitter. If you have any recommendations, we would love to hear them. We love our listeners. And everybody have a fantastic day.